Friends, family, colleagues, folks, lend me your ear. The roundtable panel is about to begin. It is Friday, the 24th of August. Very nice to have you with us on this beautiful day, and we welcome you. We have an incredible panel with us, and we're going to talk about a lot of stuff. Some of it is good news. Most of it is horrible news, and we'll talk about it in great detail. That's what we do here. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you. An old friend is with us. He's not been here for a while because he's been old globetrotting and stuff. He is Dean of International Studies at Bard College and Director of the Bard Globalization and International Affairs Program. And James Ketterer is back. Jim, how are you?
I'm doing well. It's good to be back. One correction to that.
Uh-oh.
It's just that I'm now the academic director of the Bard Globalization International Affairs Program, and my colleague is now the director, Rachel Meyer.
So you had a card game.
Yeah.
You won. She got the directorship.
She is going to do a great job.
Great.
She deserves it.
All right. Well, good for you. So very nice to have you back.
Good to be back.
We welcome your insights, which are always very thoughtful and on the mark. Speaking of, we have Aaron Pasitti with us as well. He is a professor of economics at Siena College in Loudonville, New York. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, everyone.
Also, our dear friend Judith Eng is with us, former EPA regional administrator and a longtime, you've done just about everything here in Albany, haven't you? You're a longtime activist, advocate.
I've been around the block. Recycled in different positions.
That's right. Judith Eng is with us, and good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you for being
good morning
with us.
To all our friends at the beach this morning.
Yes.
Embracing the end of summer.
And WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Yo, Joe.
Well, good to hear your voice. Thank you for being with us. And let's get going. There's, as I said, there's a lot to talk about in the news. And it seems, how many times in the last, year and a half, have we said, this could be the worst week for the president yet? Well, this one was pretty bad, right? I mean, it seems by all accounts, this was a pretty bad week for the president. And we say so because of both the conviction of Paul Manafort in federal court on 8 of 18 charges. And then, of course, there was the plea entered by his former attorney and fixer Michael Cohen that happened on that same day on Wednesday. And then, let us not forget, there was then the president, not often good at this, but in helping himself, decided to do a really long interview with Fox and Friends. What could go wrong there? So made some very interesting statements, many of which we will talk about today. One of those statements had to do with our Justice Department, and more specifically, the head of the Justice Department and our Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. President Trump blamed the Justice Department on Thursday for investigations surrounding him, criticized the deal struck with his former lawyer, and lashed out at Jeff Sessions, who countered with a rare public rebuke of the president. This all while he also praised the president, also praised Paul Manafort. Anyway, let's get to the Sessions part. Asked whether he was considering firing Mr. Sessions, the president only reiterated his longstanding objections to Mr. Sessions' recusal from the Russia investigation and his insistence that he would have chosen another person for attorney general had he known someone else would oversee the inquiry. He took the job and then he said, "I'm going to recuse myself," Mr. Trump said to Mr. Sessions. "I said, what kind of man is this?" In an implicit but pointed reply, Mr. Sessions warned the president not to intrude on federal law enforcement. Quote, "While I am attorney general, the actions of the Department of Justice will not be improperly influenced by political considerations," he said in a statement issued shortly before he met with Mr. Trump at the White House about criminal justice overhaul. And I can only think that meeting was awkward.
Frosty.
Yes. Okay. Alan, let's begin with you.
Okay, so the first thing is clear to me, and that is that Sessions knows it's all over, or thinks it's all over, because this is the first time we really have seen this incredible pushback from Sessions. And that's what you do you know, if you have nothing else to lose. So I think that's part of what is really going on here. And then secondly, you know, Lindsey Graham. Now, that was a big disappointment. I'm sure you all saw him on television. Mm-hmm. He looked insipid. He looked really oppressed. And, you know, this is a guy who can tell the truth if he has to. But he said, and this is really important, the president deserves an attorney general of his liking, basically. And if he said that, it means that the senators who had been lined up telling the president that he had better not fire Sessions were now ready to go the other way. And, of course, they don't know what to do because they're in between a rock and a hard place, right, between having to support to support the president because their constituents want them to and knowing what's right. And that's what I got to say.
And meanwhile, Alan, just one thing I want to go to is that one of the things that we always heard about Jeff Sessions in the beginning when he was hired, as well as when the recusal kerfuffle started, was that here is a guy who is very well respected by senators. He was one of them. He was very well respected. Right. He is a strong conservative. So when you say a rock and a hard place, I mean, that's exactly it, right?
Yeah, no question. Those guys don't know what to do. Those senators do not know what to do because they are all facing the potential of political extinction because this is now getting not to the Republican base, but to the independents who are going to make the decisions in so many of these cases. And that is why Sessions now speaks out, in my opinion.
And let's remember why Jeff Sessions recused himself. He, you know, this was not an act of great honor on his part, but he was implicated in having dealings with Russians during the campaign, having meetings with Russians during the campaign, and then not indicating those, went under oath in meetings before the Senate and his confirmation hearings, and having to go back and undo that. And, you know, this has the Russia element of this has been a theme underscoring it from the very beginning.
No, you're absolutely right about that. And here's what's interesting. The president keeps saying he shouldn't have taken the job if he knew he was going to recuse himself. But of course, you're absolutely right. He didn't know he was going to recuse himself until the Russian thing broke. He was already attorney general. And he said, uh-oh, I better scram.
Yeah, one of the things that bothers me about this is that for a long time in American politics, you would hear, we need a businessman to be president. We need the country to run more like a business. And businesses are concerned with their own private interests. And, you know, Trump's private interest is appealing to his base, appealing to his lieutenants and executives and secretaries that are loyal to him. And what's happening here is that, you know, the public interest is now being put secondary to Trump's private interest. So this is doing an immeasurable amount of harm to the country in terms of moving policy forward, fixing, you know, economic issues. But it's also creating a sense of a lack of confidence in public institutions. And I think that's really dangerous because the Department of Justice, you know, the Treasury Department, all of these institutions do have missions and there are checks and balances. And what Trump has been doing, and now that the noose is tightening, it's becoming way more apparent, is that he's really undermining the credibility of these institutions.
I'm sorry, Joe.
No, and I promise I'll let Judith speak here, too. But The moment I got queasy yesterday is when during that interview when he said, you know, and then the Justice Department, and I use that term in quotes,
yes. Yeah,
Justice
exactly.
Department.
Right.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I worked closely with the Justice Department when I served at EPA for 7 years during the Obama administration. And these are 201, professional, ethical, mostly career public servants who do not deserve to have their job justice in quotes. It was very striking yesterday to hear Lindsey Graham and John Cornyn essentially signal that Jeff Sessions should exit stage right. And it is a little weird that we're cheering Sessions because he really will go down. If you take away the recusal issue, he will go down as one of the worst attorneys general in the history of the country. He was very much involved in separating children at the border from their parents. He's really blocking sensible criminal justice reform. The list goes on and on. But, you know, any port in a storm, you know, we're rooting for Sessions and Omarosa. Who would have figured? But I think, you know, what we should focus on is what happens next. Let's kind of game this out a little bit. And, oh, and these guys are such profiles in courage. He should go, but not until after the November election. Like, what does 80 days matter? If the president is really entitled to his own attorney general, well, it should be today. Why wait until after the midterms? But so let's say Sessions finally gets the hint, the last guest to leave the party at 3 a.m., and he exits either on his own steam or he's dramatically fired, which would be more fun. You then have Rod Rosenstein, and you will not easily get a new AG confirmed in the Senate. I mean, you think the Kavanaugh fight is big. Wait until they try to get a new AG through, especially if it's someone like, God forbid, Rudy Giuliani or Chris Christie, who don't have the most distinguished track records. And so does he fire Rod Rosenstein because he doesn't want him to be acting? Right.
Of course he does. He has to do that in order to get to Mueller. He fires Sessions, he fires Rosenstein, he fires Mueller. And that's what he's going to do. I've been thinking about this, sitting here all morning thinking, you know, maybe the thing that has to happen here is that Mueller, and Mueller's smarter than we are, let's face it, and he has more than we do, but maybe he has to put out a preliminary report now. In other words, maybe not all of it, but some of what he has in order to protect his flank.
Well, Mueller is smart. And remember, he's been sharing some of this investigatory work with other agencies like Southern District of New York that
performed quite effectively.
The New York Attorney General's office is not involved. But I remember, you know, in this line of secession, you then get to, if Mueller and Rosenstein are fired, Senate can't get their act together to approve Attorney General Rudy Giuliani. Let's keep saying that phrase. Then you get to the number three person. And remember, that was Rachel Brand. And a few months ago, she left to take a job with Walmart, because I think she was anticipating this very scenario. I don't remember the name of the person who's now the number three, but that person may very well be the attorney general for
some
period of time.
She's a greeter now, right? She just says hi when you come.
But, you know, I think thinking of immediate next steps or whenever these next steps might happen is one important part of it. But I don't think we should lose sight of what Aaron said about the general attack on institutions. You know, I used to have a job working around the world on trying to work with governments and the U.S. government in building institutions in places that were making a transition from authoritarian regimes. And what that taught me was how hard it is to build them and how hard it is to keep them, how fragile they are.
Yes.
And so when you're talking about, you know, what has to happen, what the line of succession is, what happens in the Senate, all these are based upon a sense of trust in process and institutions. And I think we take it for granted that that will maintain itself. And I worry that as all of these attacks get some traction with Trump's base and perhaps others, that the things we're talking about may just start to not only fray at the edges, but really fall apart.
Yeah, there are some definite cracks, whether it's the Justice Department. Trump started his, I don't want to say attacks, but questioning of Federal Reserve policy, which is supposed to be independent, the Congressional Budget Office. The list goes on and on in terms of these institutions. And he's not taking them down in one fell swoop. It's these little – he's chiseling away at them. And whether he succeeds in doing that in his term, I – I highly doubt, but it really sets the stage for a real lack of confidence in public institutions. And like Jim pointed out, they're tough to build and they're tough to maintain.
So, Alan, I am curious. You've been saying this for forever, and it seems like we're pretty close to that point that the president, you've been saying, has to fire Mueller. So the Democrats, for their part, over the last 24 to 48 hours have been beating basically the same drum, which is, let's not talk about impeachment, but let's instead move legislation in the House and Senate that would prevent the president from doing that. Mm-hmm. Do you see any motion on that at all?
I don't. I think these feckless Republicans are not going to do that. They are committed to preservation of their seats, and they know one flip of the finger from the president and the constituency turns on them. And I think that's what they're really worried about. I don't see any movement to do that. I don't see any courageous people, maybe a couple of the guys who are leaving now on their own steam because they can't stand it anymore, might say something, but I don't see the votes there to do that.
Yeah, and not a one. I mean, and even Republicans who are in moderate districts, like John Faso, has he said a word about this? Elise Stefanik. I mean, they're all hiding.
Well, actually, Judith, they have all said, I believe, to be fair here, they've all said, I don't know that it means much, that the investigation ought to be completed. In other words, they're not saying nothing. They are saying that they think that the investigation itself under Mueller should go on.
Well, many Democrats are also saying that in terms of impeachment, but in terms of reacting to, I mean, I think, Joe, you started the show with this may have been the all-time worst week.
Right.
I would say the worst day for President Trump.
Wednesday was not a good day.
We haven't even talked about Mr. Pecker.
Right. But what's different about this week is we've got facts on the board. We have a jury conviction. We have a pleading by Michael Cohen. You cannot say that's part of a witch hunt. And I think this was a good week for checks and balances. The jury system, as imperfect as it is, did their job. I know that it was 14.
Well, that was, but yeah. the jury machinations in that Manafort trial, and now with two of the jurors coming out and speaking, that's fascinating.
It really is. It's
really, really interesting.
It is.
A movie made about that.
And one might say
30 seconds,
it would have been more interesting to have convictions on all, but 8 convictions is significant. So I would argue the system worked in the jury trial, and the justice system worked with Cohen doing the pleading.
We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we have some letters. Let me read those to you, and then we'll move on to some other topics because there's a lot of other stuff to talk about. Not just this issue, although they're all weirdly related, aren't they? All right, here we go. Jack says, loyalty above all. Trump's legally challenged buddies and fixers are a Twitter with the president's message, keep your mouth shut. The mafia called it silence. This Trump bunch are more like Jimmy Breslin's The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight. Get them gone. It's impeachment time. Okay. Robert writes, maybe I'm missing something about Manafort's situation, but since he's already been convicted of federal tax evasion charges, isn't he therefore wide open for New York State to charge him with evading state taxes? Since a conviction of such charges could not be nullified by a president pardon, Manafort would still be in considerable jeopardy of a lengthy prison sentence, whatever Trump does.
I don't think the state has brought a case against Manafort.
Right.
And I don't know if when you do the federal tax case, if you incorporate the state case or not. I think the state is busy on some other things.
Well, we have to worry here a little bit about, we all saw this morning that on the news that the governor, Governor Cuomo, is trying to get the legislature, I believe, to pass a law that makes it okay for the state to bring charges. Now, I know we're in a federal system, which means we have state and dual sovereignty, the state, we have the federal government. So I don't quite understand this one yet, but I think it may have to do with double jeopardy the concept that, you know, somebody's going to claim you can't charge somebody with the same crime on the state and federal levels. But whatever it is, I know that there's some concern on Cuomo's part about that.
Well, Cuomo tried to get it through during the regular legislative session. It didn't pass. I too, am confused about the necessity of it because the state, you know, Attorney General Barbara Underwood is working with New York State Tax and Finance on an enforcement case involving the Trump Organization and the Trump so-called charity.
Right.
But I also think, you know, Governor Cuomo has latched on to a very aggressive anti-Trump narrative in order to boost his chances in the Democratic primary on September 13th.
Absolutely.
He's running more against Trump than Cynthia Nixon.
Right. I think that.
Or against Mark Molinaro. Who he?
Yes, go ahead.
Who he? Right. Jamie says the woman who exposed the Russian tampering with American election system was rewarded with a 63-month sentence for being the only one to expose the scheme to the American public. Is this Trump retribution? Is there any doubt she provided a public service? Question mark. Well, crimes are crimes, right? And Dot says, I was grateful to hear that Judith Inc. has been collecting information on PFOA contamination. What a fine example she sets in a situation that needs our compassion. Well, there's Dot's fan letter. There you
Thank
go.
Thank you, Dot.
Providing credibility yes. to public institutions.
All right. Let us talk about, while we're in the New York frame of mind, let us talk about the Manhattan DA eyeing criminal charges against the Trump Organization. This story broke last night. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office is considering pursuing criminal charges against the Trump Organization and two senior company officials in connection with the Michael Cohen hush money payment to an adult film actress, according to two officials with knowledge of the matter. A state investigation would center on how the company accounted for its reimbursement to Mr. Cohen for the $130,000 that he paid to the actress, Stephanie Clifford, who has said she had an affair with President Trump. Both officials stressed that the office's review of the matter is in its earliest stages, and prosecutors have not yet made a decision on whether to proceed. State charges against the company or its executives could be significant because Mr. Trump has talked about pardoning some of his current or former aides who have faced federal charges. As president, he has no power to pardon people and corporate entities convicted of state crimes.
Alan. So there may be a political aspect to this, too. This has not been an easy year for Cy Vance, mm-hmm. you know. So maybe he's taking a look at all of this just as Cuomo is and saying, New Yorkers hate Trump. Maybe I'll have a piece of this.
Yeah, I agree with Alan. I certainly thought about the politics of that as well. You know, Cy Vance is being seen as someone who allowed Harvey Weinstein mm-hmm. to skate.
Yep.
That is really kind of hanging over him. It's not going away, and that story overall is not going away for a variety of other reasons, nor should it. And so I think looking for an opportunity for something that's both hopefully, you know, legally sound but also politically popular would certainly help Vance.
Judith?
And I think Manhattan voted, 85 or 90% for Hillary, so that would support that premise. But again, the law is the law, and if there's evidence of wrongdoing, the DA in any county, I think, has the not only the authority but the responsibility to investigate. And again, they're emphasizing this is very early. It's an investigation.
Right. Well, that's why Aaron's brilliant point was it not only had to be politically of use, but also it had to be legally sound. And I think that's right.
As much as I would like to take credit for that, I believe Jim said that.
Sorry, Jim.
But even if, but you know, even if it's not politically motivated, I mean, there
say
is
your,
a,
say your own brilliant thing.
Yeah.
Go on.
Pressure.
Boy, the bar has been set so high all of a sudden. Even if it's not politically motivated, like Judith said, a crime is a crime. And I think what you're seeing here is in a blue state, they're just dumping as much on this as they can and, you know, trying to really tighten the vise around Cohen and perhaps trying to engineer something at a much higher level by doing it at the state level.
You know, there are some ill-advised people, some of my friends, who are saying, I hope that he does fire Mueller and he does fire Sessions. And I said, not me. Not mm-hmm. me. I think it's a very tricky thing. And my friends say, well, then the people will be out in the streets with their pots and pans. Yeah? When's the last time you saw that?
Yeah, so that's it.
Yeah, so to me, the name of the game has always been keeping Mueller in place, and he's got to be thinking about this. And if he's out of there, God knows what happens next.
And let's not forget, I am so struck by the way the president is dangling the potential of pardon out there. I mean, he is really advertising that for Manafort. And I mean, why isn't that obstruction of justice? I think there are rules against offering potential pardons, especially before things are resolved. But I think that may be inspiring New York State and the Manhattan DA to jump in, because the president's presidential pardon authorities would not reach to state and local prosecutions.
And you say
not to be too I want to say historical, not hysterical, but not to be too historical about this. Under that premise, Gerry Ford might well have ended up in jail for having pardoned Nixon, because don't tell me there wasn't a deal in advance of that, of his leaving.
Well,
of Nixon's leaving. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Possibly, but what we're dealing with here is foreign interference in a presidential election, and the evidence is becoming increasingly clear. So, I mean, to dangle this out in front publicly as this is going on, as Judith pointed out, I mean, it's almost – it's not a bribe, but it really smells like one and looks like one.
Well, yeah. And you, I mean, you were saying, Judith, about this not being resolved. I mean, you still have 10 counts of as a question as to whether those are going to be retried, number one. You have another trial – coming
next
up
month.
Very
yeah.
quickly in just a matter of weeks. And there's a lot out there that still needs to be resolved before you decide on the fate of just these eight charges.
And many people are wondering, why would Manafort go forward with these expensive trials? I mean, clearly he doesn't have a good fact pattern with him. And the only reason is because you have the president of the United States praising him as a brave man who's not a rat, who's not going to flip. I think he's just counting on whatever happens in the court of law, his buddy will pardon him.
And Trump has already demonstrated his willingness to use the pardon with Sheriff Joe.
Mm-hmm. And that's what that was all about.
You're right, to send that signal from the beginning. I'm willing to use this.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, the other thing, too, is that there this whole idea of flipping, which now the president said should be illegal, is that what would Manafort, how much did Manafort know? I mean, to the point of you do have to wonder that, because even though the president said I barely knew the guy, he was still the head of his campaign.
He was the
chair
of the campaign. I think he knows a lot, Joe. I mean, he sat in on that so-called Russian adoption meeting. I mean, he got the Ukrainian plank changed in the Republican platform. I think Manafort knew a lot and knew Trump for a long time. This was not their first interaction. Manafort rented apartments in Trump Tower and has known Trump and Roger Stone for over 25 years. These guys go way back.
Had been working intensively and extensively in Ukraine. And had been working with politicians there who have all kinds of ties to Putin. I mean, that the roads that lead to Manafort are many.
And because of that, you're exactly right. We don't even have any idea how deep the Manafort potential crimes go, right? So he may be hanging on for that part because he knows there's a lot more out there, and so that it isn't only what we know about the guy, but what we don't know about him, which is why he's counting on that pardon.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other stuff. We have a lot of other stories to talk about, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And so let's talk about some other stuff before we move on from all of this palace intrigue regarding the White House. There was the story about David Pecker and the chief of National Enquirer, publisher, who is said to get immunity in the Trump inquiry. I think that's interesting as well. Federal prosecutors reached an immunity deal with the tabloid executive, a key witness in their months-long investigation into payments during the 2016 campaign to two women who said that they had affairs with Donald Trump, according to two people familiar with the investigation. Mr. Pecker is the chairman of American Media Incorporated, the nation's biggest tabloid news publisher. You may know them from the National Enquirer, which was involved in the payments, which prosecutors have identified as illegal contributions made in violation of campaign finance law. As prosecutors in New York built a case against Michael Cohen, Mr. Trump's longtime lawyer, that resulted in a guilty plea on Tuesday, Mr. Pecker emerged as an important figure. The investigation appears to be continuing, and as a longtime friend and ally of Mr. Trump, Mr. Pecker could have additional information valuable to the prosecutors. And this goes to your point, Judith, of Tuesday being a bad day.
Mm-hmm. Very bad afternoon.
Yeah.
And this is so important because he provides the corroboration for, because, you know, Michael Cohen may be not the most trustworthy witness, but there's now a second person and data to back it up. And I want to hear more about the safe where they apparently put all the key documents.
They put all the stories buried the stories. They buried them in a safe. And then prior, just the day of the inauguration or the day before the inauguration, it quote unquote moved.
Yeah. Was it burned in an incinerator or is it under this guy's mattress? Where is it? Or good chance it's in the hands of prosecutors.
I think it's telling that maybe the more trustworthy of these characters is the one who publishes the National Enquirer. If we were to imagine,
he's the guy that we're going to put our
the Omarosa. Welcome to the resistance.
Right. If we were to imagine that all this was swirling around the National Enquirer payoff to mistresses, the lawyer turning state's evidence, all of these sorts of things, and the person who was at the center of it was Barack Obama and not Donald Trump. You can imagine how the Republicans would be reacting, how many of Donald Trump's supporters would be reacting.
And when you talk about reaction, and this is apropos of absolutely nothing, but as I was watching the Fox and Friends interview, the replay of that last night, when I got to the part where he gave himself an A+, my head exploded. I thought,
well, the president always gives himself an A+.
He is
very confident.
He's an easy grader.
He's a stable genius, but he's an easy grader.
Yeah. So the other interesting thing is that in 2010, American media filed for bankruptcy. So when you talk about, the vice being tightened on Cohen and Trump and the inner circle, that this is actually prosecutors loosening a possible vice around American media's head, saying, you know, you can survive this. Financial trouble can make people do a lot of things that they otherwise might not choose to do if they were well capitalized.
Michael Cohen.
And let's remember that this guy, Mr. Pecker, is a very good friend of the president.
That's right.
And flown on his plane with him, goes to Mar-a-Lago, is an inner circle guy. It's really pretty.
He may not be invited anymore.
Yeah, not anymore. No more. He's going to have to go somewhere else in the summer.
Well, he's already getting attacked by the president. Yeah, you're right.
I want to say a very depressing thing. Many Americans read and believe what's in the National Enquirer.
And
they really pounded Hillary Clinton during the campaign. And
continue to.
Yeah, continue to. And I think that influenced votes. I mean, there's the whole, you know, dreadful story of paying for stories and killing them and putting it in the vault, but also the corrosive effect of having, you know, so many people don't take that seriously, but millions of people buy that newspaper.
You are so right.
Yeah.
You are so right. Not only that, but we had a huge fight with me on your side on the Media Project this week, in which the question was whether his National Enquirer qualifies as journalism. And my sense is, of course it does. If the people are reading it, I think I agree with you on this.
And I think this gets to the point that Donald Trump is a symptom of something deeper, that if we're sitting here and agreeing that the National Enquirer is taken seriously by people— and that it is a source of news for many people, that a variety of other kind of information sources that would otherwise be seen as way beyond the pale are also in that category. You know, this even if Donald Trump leaves the scene sooner or later, the deeper problem continues. And I think, you know, as Alan was talking about, you know, people in the street with pots and pans, I think the question is what people will be in the street reacting to what? And if there were an impeachment, I could imagine quite a severe and perhaps in places violent reactions.
You must go to see the Klansman movie, the Spike Lee movie, because it does identify who those folks are.
Yeah, I want to jump on a point that Jim mentioned about a deeper cause. And, you know, as an economist, I see it as being rooted in economics, is that, you know, since the 1970s, the, you know, average family has seen their incomes barely keep pace with inflation. Yep. You have economic mobility on the decline, where most families see that their standard of living is going to be lower than the previous generation. And that lack of hope, that lack of opportunity, and you hear, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post extol the virtues of globalization and how good, no offense, Jim, Clinton's neoliberal economic platform is going to be for, the country. And it's... a lot of people were sold a bill of lies, and I think this is probably part of the reaction to that, is they're starting to say, like, well, Democrats don't like us, Republicans, you know, don't seem to care for us, the press is lying to us, so we're just going to turn to, I mean, I don't want to say desperate measures, but last resort. And to Alan's point, those should be the people riding in the streets with pots and pans, and instead they're getting behind Trump, which seems at this point so... so depressing and so self-defeating. But then again, when the only tool you have is a hammer, like economics, every problem looks like a nail.
Or if you're a surgeon, a scalpel.
Sure.
So, sorry about that.
Anybody else on this issue? Okay.
No.
No. We're all tapped on that. All right. That's fine. I have some letters. We'll do those, and then we'll take a break and move on to other stuff. Barbara writes, why would a new attorney general have to fire Rosenstein? Couldn't he or she just take over the Russia investigation themselves?
Yes. But but Rosenstein, I think, would be on their shoulder and riding them if they didn't give Mueller the resources he needed or blocked requests for subpoenas. Everything, remember, has to go through the Department of Justice.
And Rosenstein, who's a Republican, appointed by Donald Trump.
But they have to fire Rosenstein.
Of course,
practically in order to get to Mueller.
Mark writes, John Faso may not be speaking out overtly enough against Trump, but I noticed a change in some of his town halls where he stopped referring to him as President Trump and simply says Trump, a subtle change that may indicate he is biding his time until after the elections, or perhaps this is just wishful thinking.
Perhaps.
You're going to guess on wishful thinking?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jeremy writes, getting a funny feeling that Manafort's history with Ukraine and the Russians makes it difficult or impossible for him to spill the beans voluntarily for fear of his life, or that he will be pardoned for the same subterranean. Hard to believe his role in Trump's campaign is coincidence.
Right. And here's what's been on my mind. If Manafort did not sign up to be the chair of the Trump campaign, he would have gotten away with all of this, with all the bank fraud and his international dealings.
He had a very high profile position. He could have perhaps accepted a lower profile position and not have been the target.
But let's say he had no affiliation with the Trump campaign. He would have continued to live his...
Judith.
His not well-managed life.
Fraudulent life.
Yeah.
Think of all of the congressmen who are saying that, sitting in prison cells right now, you know, and saying, if I had just not run for Congress, I might have gotten away with this.
I think he was also running out of money.
He was running out of money.
That's right.
But, you know, this is white-collar crime that largely goes undetected in our criminal justice system.
That's right.
Yet you have people who... who have minor offenses, who are sitting in jail, often because of their economic status, often because of the color of their skin, often because of the neighborhood they live in.
Right.
And then you've got these white-collar criminals stealing millions, and no one in law enforcement looks at it.
I also want to just mention, I was in Ukraine in 2014 for the presidential elections that elected Poroshenko following the Maidan protests.
Yes.
And the level of intensity of the politics of those elections, the ways in which Russia was intervening then militarily, though not officially, but also on election day that the Russians hacked the electoral system, which went down for many hours, that you know, you could see it up close. You could feel the kind of the rawness of it. And so I think this letter writer, though they say it in a very dramatic way, is certainly onto something for indicating the sense of kind of the stakes, how high the stakes are in elections like that and working in places like that and the dangers.
We got this letter from John, who says, just a clarification: of Trump and gang paid off Stormy before he signed off on getting campaign funds, there would be no crime, right? Question mark. If I use my own money to keep something private, that's not a crime.
Well, that's the question. There are many analysts of this who are saying, indeed, if he used his own money in order to influence an election, which he knew was coming up, then it's a crime.
Yeah, the timing is very important.
And the intention, I think.
Right. This wasn't 2004.
Right. And remember, happened. this is only two of the numerous charges that Michael Cohen pled guilty to, and it is a crime. There's no question it is a crime. And Cohen pled guilty. And I think President Trump is an unindicted co-conspirator.
Go ahead, Alan. Really, really quickly, I am getting a lot of mail, personal mail, about having said yesterday that the Democrats are not doing their job, that I was wrong about Schumer, who I had high expectations for, but who hasn't done that. There is no real leadership in the Democratic Party, vigorous leadership, to take him on right now.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have a lot to talk about. We have more letters, and we have a great panel. So we'll get to all of that right after this short break and news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. 7 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock on this Friday, the 24th of August. Alan Chartok, Judith Henke, Aaron Pacitti, and Jim Ketterer are all with us this morning, and we are thrilled to say that you can join us as well. We ask you, if you have a comment, you have a question, you have something you want to say, just write to us, panel@wamc.org. Keep it short, to the point, on topic, don't use abbreviations, and one per customer.
No links.
Void in Wisconsin.
Joe, can I just mention one thing before we proceed?
Sir.
So in addition to being here today, I'm an avid listener of the roundtable, and I just want to say that I really enjoy the music that takes the show back in every time, and it's great stuff. And so congratulations to whoever's doing that.
Well, that is our board op, Mike Bowen, who is giving you a salute there. Often it's also Sarah LaDuke, our producer. Today you are listening to Tinsley Ellis. That's the music bringing us in and out today. And just a note for anyone who, like Jim, and I swear to you, I didn't ask him to do that. All you have to do is go to wamc.org/roundtable, and the playlist is always there. So
good to know.
Find out more information about the music. All right, let's go to the letters. Mark says he has a recycling question for Judith.
Yay!
You live for me to say that, don't you?
Okay. I love recycling.
I recently heard that some countries are no longer recycling their recyclables because of the cost. I believe they are incinerating them instead. I also heard the problem with recyclables is spreading and is a national problem due in part because China, where the majority of recyclables go, is no longer taking them. Three questions. What happens to my recyclables after I drop them off at the town transfer station? You can answer that.
It depends on your town. Most material is still getting recycled. I don't want people to think they should stop recycling and source separating. But there are reports that some of your wonderful source separated material is not actually getting recycled. And the big problem is that we don't have enough domestic markets for this material. So historically, a lot of it was shipped to China, particularly plastics. Plastics historically has had a very, very low recycling rate. And a number of years ago, you may remember, this response is way too long, I'm sorry, Joe, but a number of years...
You still have two more questions, so just go ahead.
Yeah, years ago, and that's the show. years ago, we did more vigorous source separation, and then the waste industry gave us single stream, and people over recycle. And so they put like plastics that are not really recyclable in there, and so the whole loads get rejected, and that's one reason why China has closed its doors. So email us where you live and we'll figure out if your stuff is getting recycled.
And Mark also wants to know that, well, he says he lives in an apartment complex in Half Moon, and I have to separate my recyclables and take them to the town transfer station. Is it worth my time and effort to do this, or should I throw all my recyclables in the dumpster like my neighbors? And then he asks if this is a national problem, and if so, why?
Still source separate. Call the Half Moon Town Hall and confirm that they're recycling this. And this is a international problem. And why, for instance, we need to use less plastic packaging. There's quite a debate in Albany County. The Albany County Legislature deserves praise for passing a county-level polystyrene ban. You can't really recycle polystyrene. County Executive Dan McCoy needs to decide what to do, but I think this is a message for consumers not to buy plastics that don't even have a fighting chance of being recycled.
All right. Tristan writes, good morning. I think this is also for you, Judith. I live in Grafton within a couple miles of the Petersburg border. Should I get my well tested for PFOA? I've heard that testing for this can be expensive. Thank you all for the daily panel. I love the program and appreciate all the views and comments. I think you're fair and straight shooting.
Yes. If you're close to Petersburg and you're on a private well, you should get your well water tested. I would. And I think if you call the regional office of the Department of Environmental Conservation and plead your case, maybe, just maybe, they would do it for free, as they are in Petersburg and Hoosick Falls. What we have learned on this PFOA crisis is that the contamination is much more widespread than previously thought.
And now back to Donald Trump. Timothy writes, morning panel, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, morning panel. Nice. It's all Cyrus Vance's fault. If he charged the Trump children way back when, Trump may not have become a candidate for president. At least he would not have Ivanka and Jared in the White House. Is it too late for Vance to indict them? Alan?
I have no idea. I don't know whether it's too late, but he certainly, I mean, a DA can indict if he has a fact pattern that allows him to indict. But I would answer the point about, you know, things might have been different if he had, to the famous phrase invented by me, woulda, coulda, shoulda.
Also, Alan, don't you think Donald Trump just would have disowned Jared and Ivanka? Said, coffee people. They had nothing to do with my campaign.
No,
you think Ivanka, he's the one person he's loyal to? One?
I think he and Junior, she and Junior, are, and all reports are that he is fanatically dedicated to those folks.
Rich writes, if Trump pardons people, can he be charged with perjury if they lie when called to testify at a later trial?
That's a David Soares question.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. We'll hold that one as homework. Andy says, remember, for the last decade, the Republicans have been five steps ahead. What we see unfolding in front of us may just be theater.
No, it's a conviction and it's a pleading. It is facts.
Nah.
But I would also say about the Republicans in the last decade, you know, we can see that when we look through these events of the moment with Trump, and we look at the policies that he's seeking to put forward, not very successfully, but seeking to do so, these largely align with the Tea Party platform.
Mm-hmm.
It's not particularly different. And so this is the Congress that has been put in place over the last few elections to support these policies and support a president who is putting forward these things on, whether it's international politics, trade, taxes, immigration, et cetera. This is not a surprise. This is what the Tea Party has supported for many years.
This is a great point. The Republican Party, and not all, but many, embrace anti-environmental positions, conservative judges. I think what's new is just the reality show psychodrama.
So let me ask you guys a question on that line. Suppose the House does flip, and it flips mightily, which I think may happen, and the Democrats get into power. Would any of you advise them on what not to do?
Well, this has been written about with other countries. And I think what they really need to do is stay focused on the issues mm-hmm. and the facts and not the personality of Donald Trump. I think there's, you know, it's hard not to. I mean, that's what we talk about all the time. But if you're a member of Congress, you really should, I would advise, don't editorialize. Focus on these million people are losing health care. We're going to be breathing more air pollution. Yeah. And just keep pounding the facts, not the personality.
Well, is it possible then that the reaction could be really awful in terms of the middle range independent voters in this country? In other words, could it go too far left?
Could you go too far left?
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, well, that depends on, I mean, if you're talking about having the government seize the means of production, I think that might be too far left.
No, but I think it's single-payer health care and reduced college education.
Sure.
If that's left, bring it on.
Right. I was going to say, I mean, if you look at most advanced European economies, they have a fairly social democratic political and economic system that smooths out some of the rougher edges of capitalism. And American politics has shifted so far to the right after Reagan that that does seem to be too far left for a lot of people, despite the fact that amongst advanced economies that the U.S. seems to be the only country that doesn't provide some of these basic public goods and services for its citizens.
I'm glad I asked the question. Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
If it's just the House that flips, so we still have the Senate to deal with, so there's that impediment already. But so policy on one hand, but then the relationship to politics. So if a new House takes over the beginning of 2019, we're not very far away from the next presidential election.
Right.
So finding ways to align policy choices with the politics that lead up to that and making sure that the policy choices, and I think, Alan, this is what you're getting at, that they don't play into the hands of those who seek to reelect Donald Trump.
So as long as you've raised the question, Jim, I want to ask you this. Do you think it's possible when you're sitting there watching the television on election night that you're going to see such a surprise that the blue wave comes and the Senate goes Democratic too?
I do think it's possible. Yeah, I certainly think it's possible. But there are some races that are, excuse me, really in play, and from what I've heard, very close to call. You know, it's interesting to see even politics within the Republican Party in the Senate playing out in the issue we were talking about before.
You bet.
With Sessions. So to see Senator Grassley saying it may be time for Sessions to go, but his point has.
You mean Graham?
No,
Grassley.
Grassley has said that, mm-hmm. but not about the Russia case and Mueller and those things. It's about his Justice Department
sentencing reform
bill, the sentencing reform bill that he sees Sessions as an impediment to. So even on the politics of those policies that overlap with all of this drama of the moment is interesting to see it play out.
Even with big Senate races, all politics is local. And I to answer your question, Alan, I think there is a chance that the Senate will flip Democratic, not impossible. But then you look at a race like in New Jersey, where Senator Menendez, a Democrat, is running. His Republican opponent is only 6 points behind, and that's because Menendez had some very serious ethical challenges and a trial where he escaped conviction. But it's all going to be very localized. I think there's no question that, Schumer, Gillibrand Gillibrand's running this year. Schumer is not. Gillibrand, by the way, is doing a town hall meeting at Hudson Valley this Sunday at 5 o'clock. And it'll be interesting. I'm going to go because I want to hear what she has to say on a bunch of issues. But it's all so local.
You know, I want to respond to that. I think the possibility here is in this election that the Republicans are going to be depressed and are not going to come out, that the Democrats are going to be energized, and that would be, and I don't think it is local, Judith, I think it's going to be nationwide, and on top of course, it's not one or the other, but on top of that, I think the Democrats are in a very good spot right here.
Don't jinx it.
Of course, you're absolutely right about that.
All right. Meanwhile, elsewhere on Twitter, President Trump's promotion of a white nationalist conspiracy theory involving South Africa prompted fierce backlash there Thursday and fresh criticism in the United States that he is compromising American foreign policy to stoke his far-right political base. Former U.S. diplomats and South African leaders denounced Trump's declaration in a tweet late Wednesday that he had instructed Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to monitor the, quote, large-scale killing of white farmers and the government's expropriations of their land. White nationalist groups have for years spread false claims about the murder rates, assertions that have been widely debunked. Local police data shows the number of people murdered on farms has dropped by half over the past two decades, from 140 to 74 in 2016, that according to the Associated Press.
Jim? So this week, Jim, right, exactly.
Well, I in addition to the substance of this issue, I also take a step back and look at the kind of breakdown in process as well, having worked on foreign policy issues for the federal government. And so normally when a president speaks out about something, unless it's truly, you know, just an answer to a question at a press conference, and even in those cases,
they know what they're talking about.
And it goes through a process where you would depend on the experts, especially something that's really complicated and kind of radioactive in South Africa. We don't.
You've been leavened, buddy.
I know. We don't even have an ambassador in South Africa right now. We don't have ambassadors in many key posts around the world. I hear that under Secretary Pompeo, things have improved a bit at the State Department, but we still have many vacancies in the main State Department building in Washington. Mm-hmm. We have many vacancies in key posts around the world, and that's not a minor thing. Those people are there to be able to inform the process and say, look, on this very complicated issue, whatever it might be, here is what you need to know in Washington to be able to speak to this. This is how this intersects with American policy. These are the things to say. These are the things to avoid, et cetera. And so to tweet something out like this obviously, you know, speaks a lot to Trump and his relationship to his base, et cetera. But in addition, it really shows, a breakdown in the process and the kind of day-to-day conduct of American foreign policy. This is something we should be concerned about, not only because of a tweet like this, but what happens when there's a crisis, a real crisis that needs to be addressed, and we don't have the people in place, we don't have the processes in place, and people are just winging it. Winging it doesn't work well in serious crises with lives on the line.
I also want to point out, whenever the president has a really bad news cycle, he always turns to race. It's whether it's this, you know, really, to use the president's word, deplorable statement here involving something he knows nothing about but he heard about on Fox News, or Colin Kaepernick, his go-to, or attacking African-American members of Congress with colorful, inappropriate language, Maxine Waters and others. He just always seems to go to racial issues when he feels cornered. There's a pattern.
Mm-hmm. And let's not forget that even though the implications are far less severe than what Jim was pointing out, that during the presidential campaign, Trump was claiming that the unemployment rate was 40%, and now it's 3.9%. And I mean, this is just somebody, like, facts are irrelevant at this point, and it's really tough to have, whether it's foreign policy or domestic economic policy, when the rules of the game become so muddied, where statistics that have been validated for decades are just meaningless. Again, it goes back to the diminishing faith in public institutions, and it leaves people just shaking their head wondering who they can trust. And
so
that's the first step towards authoritarianism.
So, Aaron, you wouldn't agree truth isn't truth.
That's so postmodern of you.
But on South Africa, too, I think it's also interesting to keep in mind that the interplay between the U.S. and South Africa on race issues has been one of longstanding. I mean, this has been brought up in a virulent and kind of very ugly way. But, you know, during the 1980s, the anti-apartheid movement here in the U.S., pushing back against Reagan and his policy of constructive engagement, et cetera, Robert Kennedy took a very famous trip to South Africa in 1966, And he did that not only in his role as a senator representing the United States overseas on these sorts of trips, but also as a way to resonate with mm-hmm. the American civil rights movement and to give it some different perspective and to highlight what was going on with, you know, the very dark days of apartheid in South Africa. There's some, you know, one of his most famous speeches was given there. So, it calls out even more right. for having yes. an ambassador there, for knowing what we're talking about. This is a big, important country, and it's been tied to the U.S. in different ways over time. And, you know, we need to take these things seriously. We need to have serious people in place who take them seriously.
Alan, we have about 30 seconds. You want the last word?
Yes, I want the last word to say you got to get a contractor in front of Jim. The panel is great, but it's so good to have him here, and we really need him more than we've had him.
Well, thank you for saying that, Alan, although I'm feeling bad that every time I'm here, I don't get to see you. So I won't take it personally.
Hey, nobody knows that.
Until now.
No, he's here. He's just in the other room. See, yes. He's right there. All right. Well, good morning. Thank you very much. I would say that was as the kids say, a kick-ass panel. Very nice. Yeah. Very nicely done.
Ocho.
Have a great weekend. We'll be back with more show after this.